America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you on this Monday, the 2nd of April. Did you get April fooled yesterday? There were some good ones out there. Our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson: I'd rather be exposed to the inconveniences attending to too much liberty than those to attending to too small a degree of it. The problem is, how do you slice and dice that word liberty? For example, the Bush administration said that part of liberty is being able to emit all the greenhouse gases you want, and that the federal government should not have the right to restrict that. That the Clean Air Act did not allow the EPA to restrict carbon dioxide. This was the position of the Bush administration after George W. Bush had campaigned on a campaign of, yes, I will consider carbon dioxide a pollutant. He changed his mind. Well, just a few hours ago, the Supreme Court issued a ruling, 5-4 decision, a stunning rebuke, it's being referred to in the media, to the Bush administration, that the federal government does indeed have the authority to regulate greenhouse gases linked to global warming. And this is, you know, pretty straightforward. So here we have this, another case, Legeen Creative Leather Products versus PSKS, Inc. This was argued on March 26th. I don't see that this one has come down yet, but I wanted to get Harry Binswanger on and talk about it. In any case, because we'll see. I mean, we may find out later today. The justices are going to decide whether antitrust law forbids a manufacturer from setting a minimum retail price for its products. The court in the past has ruled that this is called price fixing. Harry, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you, Tom.
HBList.com, your website, by the way, and I should say Harry is a specialist in objectivism with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, their website. The objectivists at Ayn Rand being the folks who have informed the thinking of many libertarians and many of the modern-day conservatives of the Grover Norquist and similar variety, Dick Armey variety, although I realize that you guys have no affiliation with each other and you consider them far more diluted and less true to the cause than you are. Harry, will a free market without government intervention ever work for the good of the people? I mean, give me an example.
Well, the whole of the 19th century was the free market raising up America from a degree of poverty that's unimaginable to be rivals of Britain for the leader of the world.
Let's see, the 19th century, where we had five Great Depressions, we had a civil war, and by the end of the 19th century, more than 90% of Americans were living on less than $10,000 a year in today's dollars. That was a time that, you know, and the robber barons were richer than anybody had ever seen before in the history of the United States. That's what you think is an ideal economy?
Absolutely. Absolutely, it was an ideal. There weren't five Great Depressions. There were no Great Depressions in the 19th century. There were panics, which were short-lived, and only
short-lived meaning 3 to 5 years.
There was no five-year panic. Most of the panics were over in a year, and they affected only the speculative interests. You know who gave a good history of this was Alan Greenspan when he was an associate of Ayn Rand's. He had a history of panics that, in a course that I listened to, a history of panics in the 19th century, all of which were caused by government either going off the gold standard or threatening to. The real Great Depression was created by government, by the Federal Reserve Board, which artificially raised interest rates after having kept them low. But this is a little bit.
You realize your declaration of the cause of the Republican Great Depression would be disputed by a lot of historians here.
You mean the New Deal caused depression? Is that what you're referring to?
Because the New Deal came after the Great Depression had already started.
Herbert Hoover launched all those New Deal, not all, but the majority of those New Deal programs were formulated and begun under his administration. He was
Social Security came about 1935. The Wagner Act was 1935. FDR was elected in 1932.
Nobody believes that Social Security was what brought us out of the Depression. It's the NRA-type programs, the government pump-priming programs that people wrongly attribute to the New Deal bringing us out of the Depression. All those were begun on.
So are you saying Herbert Hoover started the WPA and the CCC?
Not those by that name, but he formulated programs of that kind, and specifically to get the economy continuing to grow. Remember, Roosevelt didn't come in until 33. So there was, between the crash of 29 and Roosevelt's coming in, there was a lot of frantic scrambling by Hoover to fix things as he saw it, only making them worse.
Well, you know,
but anyway,
we can debate history all day long, Harry. The bottom line here is we have this case before the Supreme Court where the justices are going to decide whether or not antitrust law forbids a manufacturer from setting prices of price fixing. And your position on this, if I understand it correctly, is that price fixing is just fine. Thank you very much. This is none of the government's business.
That's right. It's not the government's business to interfere in capitalistic acts between consenting adults.
So if you have a capitalist society, and as a consequence of there being no government restrictions whatsoever, all of the mid-sized companies get bought up by one giant company, and you basically only have one single company that's a vendor to the marketplace, and or a very small handful that work together in a way that we might call today collusion, and they start fixing prices in the marketplace, you don't think that there should be any remedy for that?
Because
that's what's happened in the past.
Right.
I mean, that's exactly what John Rockefeller was doing in the 1880s and 1890s.
Yes, and the result was cheap oil for all. Yeah, I'm in favor of industrial concentration if the market creates it, not if government sponsors it. If the market creates it, it's because it's more efficient.
What Rockefeller was doing was driving his competitors out of business by competing, by conspiring with the railroads. He'd say to the railroads, I'll give you a little kickback if you'll refuse to ship their oil.
Yes, that's called, what did you call it, a kickback and a little conspiracy? I call it good business practices. And everybody benefited by the fact that oil shipped in volume saves money for people where oil shipped quart by quart.
Everybody benefited except any small businesses or any medium-sized businesses.
Right,
they all
true.
Got wiped out.
That's true. But they benefited by living in a system in which competition is won by the most efficient producer.
Where they could all give up the dream of being an entrepreneur or owning their own small business, and they could simply become a minimum wage worker for one of the robber barons.
It's funny to see you defending the businessmen who lose.
I have always defended small and medium-sized businesses. My problem, to quote Teddy Roosevelt, problem is with big business.
No, your problem is you want to defend the inefficient producers. They might be small, they might be big, the ones who lose the competition. If they lose, they should go into something else.
If inefficiency means that society's good is being more well served than by efficiency, then I will cop to it that I'm in favor of inefficiency here.
Okay.
I don't hold efficiency to be the highest value in our society. I hold the highest value to be in our society that which is best for our society and that which maximizes personal liberty and societal good at the same time. And I see absolute unrestrained laissez-faire capitalism, the type that you're suggesting, and certainly the last half of the 19th century, the era of the Gilded Age of the robber barons, as being an example of what goes wrong when capitalism runs amok.
Yeah, well, you see, we have read different economic histories. I think that
you're not denying that most people in America in the last half of the 19th century were living in poverty.
No, I'm not.
How is that good for society?
What can we conclude from that? What were they living at in most of the beginning of the 19th century, the beginning of the 18th century, beginning of the 17th century, beginning of the 16th century?
Throughout the 18th century, we had a very large middle class in the United States.
Back onto the evolution of the ape. It was capitalism that raised man out of poverty for the first time in history. And it's capitalism that the third world countries need now so that they have a chance to join industrial civilization and get.
You're suggesting that. No, I have to strongly disagree with you. I think that, some elements of capital, actually I would say free enterprise has been an engine that has been driving all this. But again, you're suggesting that Thomas Hobbes was right and that the natural state of man is poverty and war?
No, I'm saying that wealth is created and men begin in poverty until they learn how to create enough
I would suggest that there's a lot of people living around the world in Aboriginal and Indigenous societies don't consider themselves in poverty. They consider life pretty good. You're not going to go there.
I didn't quite hear all of that. Son.
Oh, okay. Well, we have to wrap it up. Harry, you defend your position really well. I appreciate it. AyonRand.org and HBList.com. Harry Binswanger with the Ayn Rand Institute.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you, Harry. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
At the end of the tunnel of talk radio. It's Air America Radio. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. The Bush administration, in a major escalation of trade pressure on China, said Friday it would reverse more than 20 years of American policy and impose potentially steep tariffs on Chinese manufactured goods on the grounds that China is illegally subsidizing some of its exports. This is Stephen Weissman writing in the New York Times on Saturday or Sunday. I forget which day it was, over the weekend. In any case, a major shift, U.S. imposing tariffs on China. Speaking of regulating capitalism, keep in mind that 40% of all global trade is within individual corporations. That is, the corporation sets up a division overseas and then sells to their division here in the United States, and then they get to decide how much they're selling to themselves so they can decide whether they're going to have their profits in the overseas company or in the U.S. company. Because if they sell to themselves in the United States at a high price, then their profits are in the overseas company. And if that's a country where the taxes are very low, then they cut their tax bill. If they sell to themselves at a very low price, then they can shift their profits into the United States. Or if it's a company like Kellogg, Brown & Root, they may be based in the Cayman Islands or something, you know, to avoid taxes altogether. Or Halliburton now moving to Dubai. In any case, tariffs. The Bush administration. And notice that it would reverse more than 20 years of American policy. Again, I keep telling you, this all started with Reagan. Reagan, Bush Sr., and Clinton, and now Bush Jr., these four presidents, reversed 200 years of U.S. trade policy, in large part because of an ideology being promoted by a book called The Lexus and the Olive Tree, Tom Friedman. This whole notion that, oh, everything will be fine if you just hand it over to multinational corporations. Sorry, the world is not flat. As a consequence of this insane trade policy that we've been pursuing for the better part of 20 years, as Stephen Weissman notes in the New York Times, the American trade deficit with China reached a record $232.5 billion last year, about a third of our entire trade gap. The tariffs that they're going to slap on high-gloss paper, this is the paper that's used to make really high-end magazines and advertising and things like that, very high-gloss paper, which allows color, when you print color on it, it really pops because it reflects light so much better. 10.49% for one company, 20.4% for another of the Chinese companies. Why? Well, because we're saying that they're being illegally subsidized by the Chinese government. See, there's this whole variety of reasons why you can say why a nation, and why they do, by the way, why you can say if somebody wants to import a product into our country, they're going to have to pay a tax on that import, a tariff. The traditional reasons included that there are some industries that we simply want to protect here because they're essential to our survival. We want to make sure that we have the ability here at home if there were, say, a world war or a world disaster, to produce food. So we have tariffs on certain food products so that we can say, you know, this is really something that we'd like to keep here. We want to make sure that we're food self-sufficient. There, you know, historically had been import tariffs and ways of protecting industries that had to do with manufacturing things, particularly things that might have to do with defense. You know, we've largely done away with those. We can't even make a missile now without ships from China. Tell me that makes sense. And so now one of the reasons is for national defense. One of the reasons is, you know, good cogent national policy. Another reason is to keep jobs in the country. That is to protect workers. Well, that went out the window with Reagan. I mean, Reagan declared war on working people back in 1981. It was just, you know, that was the end of that. And we've gone from 25% unionization when Reagan came into office to in the private sector now, what, 6, 7, 8%, something like in that neighborhood, depending on whose numbers you're using as a consequence of that. But in large part, this is the result of these insane trade policies. And nobody wants to talk about this. I mean, I bring it up with Charlie Rangel and suddenly his phone disconnects. No politicians want to talk about this because they are all so wired into these huge multinational corporations. And they all believe that they've been drinking this Kool-Aid for 25 years while they're starting to wake up, even in the Bush administration. In fact, Weissman in the New York Times, he notes, this new policy could lead to duties on imports of Chinese steel, plastics, machinery, textiles, and many other products sold in the United States. Okay, cool. Let's take it beyond just saying, okay, we're going to impose tariffs because you guys are subsidizing industries. And let's take it to the next logical step and talk about the possibility of importing tariffs for the same reason that Japan has import tariffs, for the same reason China has import tariffs. You want to sell a U.S. car in China, it's a 20% import tariff. For the same reason that virtually every other country in the world has import tariffs, and that is that you want to defend your jobs. You want to protect your industries. You want to do it in a strategic and intelligent way. You want to participate in world trade, but you want to do it intelligently. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Past the hour, the place where being progressive never felt so good. Tom Hartman here with you. Another example of what happens when the entire line of distribution, from pulling the product out of the ground to refining it to selling it to shipping it to selling it at retail, are all owned by the same company or a small handful of companies in the same industry. Speaking here of fossil fuels, Laura Meckler, in an article in the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, another good argument, although it doesn't get mentioned anywhere in the article, of course, but another good argument for let's enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act. In fact, let's bring it back and strengthen it. The headline of the article, of Laura Meckler's article, and it's some very, very good reporting here in today's Wall Street Journal. Fill up with ethanol. One obstacle is big oil. She writes, there are a number of reasons that would be why you can't find ethanol, E85, 85% ethanol, at your local gas station. There are a number of reasons, but one big one is resistance from oil companies. Oh, gee, what a surprise. Now, why would the oil companies not want to sell E85? After all, you make a profit at the sale of it at retail. Well, because most of their revenue doesn't come from retail sales. It comes from everything all along the way. It gets marked up over and over and over again, from themselves to themselves. As Laura Meckler writes, oil companies lose sales every time a driver chooses E85, and they employ a variety of tactics that help keep the fuel out of stations that bear the company's name. For instance, franchises sometimes are required to purchase all the fuel they sell from the oil companies. Since oil companies generally don't sell E85, the stations can't either, unless the company grants an exception and lets them buy from another supplier. Contracts sometimes limit advertising of E85 and restrict the use of credit cards to pay for it. Sure, you can sell E85, you can sell ethanol, you just can't take credit cards in payment. Some require that any E85 pump be on a separate island and not under the main canopy. Oh, yeah, you can buy E85, but you got to spend $200,000 to dig a hole, put a tank in over on the other side of the gas station, put up another canopy, put another pump on top. Yeah, a lot of these small franchises, I don't think so. Less than 1% of America's 170,000 gas stations have E85. Why? Well, it turns out, because big oil won't let it happen. A Chevron agreement, she writes, with franchisees also appears to discourage selling E85 under the main canopy. A ConocoPhillips memo to franchisees says the company doesn't allow E85 sales under the primary islands. Chevron says it requires Chevron and Texaco branded stations to keep E85 off their primary signs listing fuel prices. Yeah, you could sell it, but you can't advertise it. Another Chevron recommendation makes it much more expensive for a station to offer E85 at all. Stations usually have three tanks, and then she goes through how, you know, you've got to get another pump and all this. But Chevron's agreement with station owners recommends they install new pumps and tanks at their own expense if they want to stock E85. Does Chevron, does Texaco, does ExxonMobil give a damn about what's best for the United States, the future of the world, the atmosphere? Well, the tragic truth is, and it's not that they're evil people or evil companies, the tragic truth is that in a pure capitalist system, you even have the Supreme Court saying that if they don't decide what's best for them financially, to hell with the rest of the world. If they don't make decisions based on what's best for them financially, then they are failing to fulfill their fiduciary responsibility to their stockholders, and they are committing a crime. And I think it's about time that the rest of us said, no, wait a minute. There is a higher value than profit for stockholders. That's a fine value. We're not diminishing the fact that profit for stockholders is a high and important value, but there are other values that have to come into the mix. What is good for society as a whole? What is good for the working people of a country? What is good for the nation in its competition with other nations and the dynamic of having to live with other nations? What is good for the planet? What is good for all life on Earth? What is good for community? And let's start balancing these. And also the externalities. Sure, you want to sell gasoline, no problem. However, that $4 gallon of gasoline or $3 gallon of gasoline, there's $3 worth of U.S. defense in that gasoline that isn't being passed along. The oil companies have our entire military apparatus all over the planet defending our shipping lines. We're paying for that with our tax dollars. They're not paying for it. So you don't pay for it at the pump. So it's a subsidy. It is corporate welfare, number one. And number two, you got 1 in 3 Americans going to get cancer in their lifetime. Another article in the Sunday paper about how cancer is this growth industry. Why are hospitals offering free cancer screening? Because it's profitable. And this huge growth industry out there, one of the primary sources of carcinogens in our world, fossil fuels. There's another $2 worth of cancer costs in every gallon of gasoline if you distribute it across the cost of everybody getting cancer as a consequence of the use of hydrocarbons. Are we paying that at the pump? No. If we did, maybe we'd use less gasoline and we'd burn more ethanol. But that wouldn't be good for ExxonMobil, would it? John in San Diego, California. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, your guest that you had on only told half the story of why a monopoly is good. It's like the 50-gallon of gulp water to thirsty people in the desert. The object of a monopoly is to get rid of all the competition so that what were originally low prices, you can now set without limits.
That's right. So you can you become the controller of profits, because as both John Locke and Adam Smith pointed out, the typically speaking, the price of goods in a marketplace is a function of the supply of those goods in the marketplace. And if you can limit the supply by becoming a monopoly, you can drive the price up and drive your profits up.
Yeah. Does anyone wonder why the smallest bits of carbon called diamonds cost so much? It's because there's a monopoly on them so that you can pay, you know, thousands of dollars per carat. It's not because they are intrinsically worth thousands of dollars. And it's called buying, everybody's heard this, where you buy market share, you go in under cost just so you can drive out the competition. And once that's done, you'll be paid back later by your unfettered price rising.
Oh, sure. Look at how, you know, and there's a long history of this, John. Thanks for the call. Walmart goes into communities and they run all these sales and they buy all local advertising and the local businesses, the local power structure goes, oh, isn't this cool? Walmart's coming in town and they're buying local advertising. The newspapers are supporting them and they're running all these sales that sometimes seem to be targeted at local businesses. And then when the local hardware store is out of business and the local textile shop, the local place where you can buy sheets and pillowcases is out of business and the local clothing, then the prices just seem to go up a little bit. Chris in Seattle, this isn't just Walmart. I mean, this is just right across the board. Any of these big companies that come in and drive the smaller ones out of business. Chris, welcome. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing? I'm also coming. Yes, if we were to give him, just for the sake of argument, that when he was saying how it was great that at the 19th century, the majority of people are in poverty and the robber barons are doing great, just for the sake of argument, if we say that was okay, but we equate it to today's economy, it's ridiculous. We are a consumer-driven economy. It would crash. We would have people buying VCRs and going to your local restaurants that drive this economy.
Submit to you that the 19th century economy was consumer driven too, and that's one of the reasons why there were all these panics, is because it was periodically crashing. It was constantly teetering on the edge.
Yeah, so what was he thinking? I don't know.
Well, you know, we have different stories of history. He was listening to Ayn Rand and Alan Greenspan, and I guess, reading other history books. But good point, Chris. Thanks very much for the call. I appreciate it. Ken in New York City. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind today? Ken? No, Ken. Okay, we'll try this again here. Joe in Atlantic Heights, New Jersey. Hey, Joe.
Atlantic Highlands, New Jersey.
Highlands, I'm sorry. Thank you.
I was going to say some of the things that the callers just said, but I'll point out something else. There was a good article on commondreams.org. It was called Football Socialism, and it shows that the NFL would not be doing nearly as well today if they let just the dominant teams keep all the profits that they made and drive out the other teams to extinction. You wouldn't have a
Yeah, well, and not only that, I mean, baseball is one of the only industries in the United States that has an exemption from antitrust regulations, baseball and insurance.
Well, the point of the Football Socialism article is that by revenue sharing, the weaker teams get a leg up and they can get some good players and keep the competition going.
Oh, right. Yeah, and the industry did this itself, did it not?
Right, exactly. And it's been very good for the NFL to share the wealth, so to speak, rather than for the winners to keep it all.
Yeah, they look at it and they say, okay, yeah, how can we do this and make it work best for us? Joe, thanks for the point. Ralph in Baton Rouge. Hey, Ralph, just a few seconds before we've got to take a break. A quick point you want to make?
Bad guy there. No, I don't agree with him. And I kind of agree with you on some of that. But his point is, they come in there and they wiped out about half the middle class in the 30s in that depression, because the middle class is the small business people and the small farmers.
Mm-hmm.
That was your middle
class. Yeah, small farmers principally.
And we've created this, what we call, and I call it a high class working society, and they're the ones getting burnt in this deal here now. But
I was small
getting
at
it, a farm up there, and Cargill wants to put an alcohol plant in.
Ralph, hold that thought for just a second here. I want to pick this up on the other side of the break here. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with Ralph in just a moment. The Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Limbaugh, he'll want some.
In broadcasting, this is the Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We were talking to Ralph in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. You're talking about what happened in the 80s because of the monopolies in the farms, Ralph. If you can give us a little summary.
Well, see, what I'm saying is, when they come in there and they took the Parity Act out, which was protecting us in the marketplace, the corporations had already been out there developing their own feeding operations and stuff. And now by, like, Cargill building their own alcohol plant, they're going to make alcohol, sell it into the market, get the government to subsidize them, and then they'll have free feed to feed to their livestock operation. And there's some big farmers left with livestock operations, but they're going to take them out with this. Because you can't compete against them.
So, and this is what Willie Nelson and these guys were out there with,
right.
Farm Aid and everything.
They talked to me back there when they set up Farm Aid, and I told them that they ought to spend the money and buy lawyers to defend the farmers. I think we should have took the money and put it on and got it and started getting us some politicians in office.
Yeah.
It's a mess. But what they're doing is they're monopolizing this country. And I'm like you, you can just work for nothing, or you can go work in there, or you can maybe try to sell drugs or make money illegal stealing or something, and you can spend time over there in their slave shop, the prisons.
You lost your farm in the 80s from this, Ralph?
Huh? Do what?
You lost your farm in the 80s to the
Well,
the
no, we rebuilt it. I wouldn't get off, and we fought with them, and then they'd come out, and then they brought some colonels around, and they started putting stuff in the paper. The guys like me were anti-Semitic, which wasn't true. You know how they can start controlling things and getting people turning against you.
Yeah, I got it. Ralph, thanks a lot for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it. Wayne in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
Oh, good morning. I got a comment on your guest from the Ayn Rand Institute and the philosophy of efficiency is the highest good, or it seems like it's the only good. Eventually, that leads to the most efficient way of acquiring wealth, if you can get away with it, is offing your neighbor and taking his stuff.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I think they're operating, in defensive of Harry and the Ayn Rand philosophy, even though I totally disagree with it, or largely disagree with it, I would submit that they do believe that this has to operate within some kind of moral context. The problem is, how do you define that morality?
Right.
But,
well,
point taken. Well,
I've got an example for you, Tom, and that's the oil of Iraq was owned by the nation of Iraq, and the most efficient way for the oil companies to get their hands on that oil was to get someone to steal it for them and make huge profits in doing it. This is that same philosophy.
And in fact, one of the benchmarks that is embedded in this bill that the Democrats pushed through and are passing along to Bush that is quite acceptable to the Republicans, thank you very much. One of the benchmarks is that the Fossil Fuel Act has to be passed through the Iraqi legislature, and that's an act that will give control of about three-quarters of all of Iraq's oil to three or four large American oil companies. And you go back and you look at the notes from Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force meeting in March and April of 2001, before 9/11, and they had, Saddam Hussein's internal stuff, all the information on who Hussein was thinking of selling his oil to, and there wasn't a single oil company on that list, and they just considered that absolutely intolerable. And, so here we are, and you got, now John McCain walking around. Well, we'll get into that in the next hour, but Wayne, thanks a lot for the call. Gene in San Francisco. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Oh, hi, thanks for taking my call, Tom. I'm an old art historian type. And after years of seeing the artists manipulated for the purpose of the totalitarian church or fascists or anything like that, what I see always is when creativity is under the heel. And I, as your previous caller was talking about efficiency, I think that's a false frame. I see the profiteers your guest was talking about as mere bean counters versus the actual creative minds. And in that...
Well, that's a good point.
And in
if you look at history, there have been two periods of great creativity, or three periods of great creativity, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, and the mid-20th century. And each one came about as a result of the emergence of a middle class. Outside of that, when you look at most of the history of feudal Europe, the artists were always subsidized by wealthy people. There was a very small supply of them, and they were relatively famous, but they made their money either by doing things for the church, Mozart and Beethoven writing, pieces for the church in order to make a living, or for very wealthy people.
Yes, and it's the creativity that's so wonderful. Your guest defended the scams of unfettered business, squeezing out all the other competition. The point I want to make is that the big guys steal ideas from the small guys and then capitalize on them. The big guys rarely come up with ongoing creative solutions, but pick one thing and invest in it until it becomes a detriment to society, such as the fossil fuel versus ethanol item you were reading out of the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, and that was a great example. Gene, well said. Thank you very much. Harry in Driving in New Jersey. Hey, Harry.
Yes, yeah, hello. Tom Hartman.
You're on the air, yeah.
Hi. I wanted to comment on what Harry said earlier about 19th century economics.
Right.
And the first tariff was passed in 1816. Then it was
actually, the first tariffs were passed in 1786, but there were some substantial increases in the tariffs in the early 19th century.
And then we have Henry Clay's American system in 1820, which allowed for the construction of roads. Then we had the tariff of 1828, which led to South Carolina ratifying a nullification, which allowed Andrew Jackson to pass a force bill to invade South Carolina in 1832. Of course, that never happened. But then we can go into the awarding of deeds to the railroads. And
it's a massive socialism project.
Labor unions directly by government. So to say that 19th century was simply laissez-faire politics is really a misperception of history.
No, it was an era of massive corporate welfare and massive poverty as a result of that and massive exploitation of people, particularly of working people right across the United States.
Right, and even should a dollar be backed by silver or gold was a debate that happened in the 19th century. And we know how that was won out as well.
Yeah, well, and ultimately, Nixon took us out of that one in 72, as I recall. But in any case, good point. Thank you very much. 57 minutes past the hour. John McCain strutting and Lindsey Graham strutting around Iraq with what? 100 armed guards, a couple of Apache helicopters? Right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
Well, this is absolutely incredible to watch. Thanks for joining us. Tom Hartman here with you. The political assassination of a reporter. Matt Drudge trying to assassinate Michael Ware over on his website for calling out John McCain on not telling the truth. This is really and truly mind-boggling. Over at Drudge's website, let's just real quickly here take a sneak peek and see if he's still got it up. It was this morning, really. This is, exclusive. McCain heckled by CNN reporter, and then CNN responds. Okay, he took down the site that said that that Ware was basically an alcoholic, which was from a joke that Michael Ware had said on the Daily Show, or on Bill Maher's show. But first of all, let's get back to the beginning here. The very beginning of this was John McCain last week. As I recall, it was toward the beginning of last week, saying that things are working just fine, thank you very much, in Iraq. Everything's cool. You know, you can walk around. You walk freely. It's really quite safe. Everything is just groovy, you know, or what I guess that would be. I don't know how McCain would say it, but, well, actually, I mean, we can just actually listen to McCain saying it. Here he is.
Everything we hear that if you leave the so-called green zone, the international zone, and you go outside of that secure area, relatively speaking, you're in trouble if you're an American.
You know, that's where you ought to catch up on things. Wolf, General Petraeus goes out there almost every day in an unarmed Humvee. I think you ought to catch up. You see, you are giving the old line of 3 months ago. I understand it. You certainly don't get it through the filter of some of the media, but I know for a fact that much of the success we're experiencing, including the ability of Americans in many parts, not all. We've got a long, long way to go. We only got two of the five brigades there to go into some neighborhoods in Baghdad in a secure fashion.
Yeah. So then Michael Ware says, wait a minute, I think this guy is in Neverland.
Has there been this improvement that Senator McCain is speaking about?
Well, I'd certainly like to bring Senator McCain up to speed if he ever gives me the opportunity. And if I have any difficulty hearing you right now, Wolf, that's because of the helicopters circling overhead and the gun battle that is blazing away just a few blocks down the road.
Yeah, and then he goes on to talk about, you know, how rough it is. So McCain, immediately, in order to, I mean, this could be a campaign killer. In fact, frankly, I thought it was. I thought, that's it. McCain is toast. This is evidence that the guy is either delusional or he's got early stage Alzheimer's. I mean, this is Ronald Reagan all over again. Reagan talking about, you know, things he'd seen in movies as if they were real. And so what does McCain do? He hops on a plane and goes over to Baghdad and says, let's go out and walk outside the green zone in a market. So they get 100 heavily armed soldiers, 3 Black Hawk helicopters, 2 Apache gunships. They go through the neighborhood, do a security sweep on the neighborhood, plant informants from the Iraqi army dressed in civilian clothes all through the neighborhood so that it, you know, it looks like it's full of Iraqis and everything's fine. And then McCain walks through and holds a press conference. And he's there an hour. And Lindsey Graham just thinks this is just the coolest thing. He's along with him.
What we're doing today is different. And to say it's not different is just really not being fair. We have a fundamentally different approach to our security problems. We're doing now what we should have done 3 years ago.
Right.
And there is some signs of success. Went to the market, and we were just really warmly welcomed. I bought 5 rugs for $5.
I bought 5 rugs for $5. Proof that all is well. They're so happy we're there. Of course, it might have been an Iraqi army guy posing as a vendor. I don't know, because that's what it took. I mean, this is... So, then McCain holds a press conference, and Michael Ware is at the press conference, and Drudge starts reporting... Well, here's the... Quote, this is an exclusive, right? Yesterday, this is from the Think Progress blog over at the Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org. Yesterday, right-wing internet gossip Matt Drudge posted an exclusive report based on an anonymous unnamed source claiming that Michael Ware had acted inappropriately during a weekend press conference and implying that Ware is an alcoholic. And this is the quote from the Drudge Report. During a live press conference in Baghdad, Senators McCain and Graham were heckled by CNN reporter Michael Ware. An official at the press conference called Ware's conduct outrageous, saying, here you have 2 United States senators in Baghdad giving firsthand reports while Ware is laughing and mocking their comments. I've never witnessed such disrespect. This guy is an activist, not a reporter. So on CNN this morning, Michael Ware asked about this. Tells, as they say, the rest of the story.
Let me ask you a question. There was a report that said you were heckling and you were laughing during the senator's press conference. Is that true?
Well, let's bear in mind that this is a report that was leaked by an unnamed official of some kind to a blog, to somewhere on the internet. No one has gone and put their name forward. We certainly haven't heard Senator McCain say anything about it, or any of his staff have come forward to say anything about it. I did not heckle the senator. Indeed, I didn't say a word. I didn't even ask a question. In fact, when I raised my hand to ask a question, the press conference abruptly ended. So what I would suggest is that anyone who has any queries about whether I heckled, watch the videotape of the press conference. Soledad?
So there you go. It's a lie, in other words. It's just the bottom line, very, very straightforward. And then Drudge had this link about, well, Ware says that he's drinking all the time.
He's been Time Magazine's Baghdad bureau chief throughout the war in Iraq. Live from Baghdad, Michael Ware. Michael, how you doing?
This, of course, Bill Maher's show.
Now, you're really in Baghdad, right? That's not a fake backdrop of a mosque, is it?
Oh, look, I'm really sad to say, yeah, I actually am here.
Yeah, I know you are, and, you know.
Well, anyhow, they go through this thing, and he says, yeah, I've been given a front row ticket to watch this slow-motion train wreck. I'm trying to stay as drunk as long as possible while I'm here. In fact, I'm drinking now. And it was a joke. I mean, he's on a comedy show with a comedian, and he's trying to out-joke the comedian, which is always a bad idea if you go on a comedy show with a comedian, because you just can't do it. But amazing. It's absolutely amazing. So here we have this senator, actually two senators, saying that because they took a neighborhood, a couple of square blocks, and came in with 100 heavily armed soldiers, they're wearing flak jackets, they're wearing bulletproof vests, you got two Black Hawk helicopters, two Apache gunships, and they can walk around for an hour, that everything's fine. Everything's fine. Which brings me to a question that was asked to me on Friday by John Scott in San Francisco when I was down there. And John was asking it rhetorically. I mean, he's a good guy, and he was playing the devil's advocate. And in the live afternoon show that we did from the Fox Theater down there for the quake. And he says words to the effect of, well, you know, the people on the right say that if we leave, the enemy, and I said, stop right there. See, that's the frame that we've got to be very, very careful of ever going even close to, because by and large, I mean, vastly, 95, 96, 97, 98%, the vast majority of, quote, the enemy, the people who are shooting at us in Iraq, are the guys who 5 years ago were the car mechanic down the street, the civil servant, the guy who was a grunt in the army, the guy who was just working down the street at the local candy shop. I mean, these were people who had a life, the students, people who, you know, teachers, you know, police officers right across. And now they're out of work because we brought them laissez-faire capitalism. We changed their constitution. They're out of work. And their nation is occupied. They had their front door kicked in. They had their family humiliated. They're really upset about this. So where do we go with this thing? Where do we go? Gary Trudeau in Doonesbury over the weekend laid out the very best suggestion for what we should be doing going forward legislatively. That up next. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
6 6 3 0 3 22 70.
Hey, this is Tom Hartman. We appear to be having a bit of a technical problem right now. I'll be back live with you in just a few minutes, but for the moment, just hang on and enjoy this music.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody is free. And that's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
Ah, we're back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Sorry, we lost our ISDN line there for a second. And the engineers are scrambling. But anyhow, we're here. We're here and we're back. The snipers have returned. Now, the rest of the story. Right? You hear the beginning of the story. McCain puts his foot in his mouth, huge, on national television. Then he starts dancing around going, well, I didn't mean, really mean to say that General Petraeus drives around in an open Cadillac, you know, convertible or something. But actually, he did say that General Petraeus is driving around without, but in any case, so he managed to get the media not to talk about that anymore. We're not talking about that. And then he goes over there with Lindsey Graham and they walk around and they hold a press conference. And then Drudge tries to smear Michael Ware, who didn't even ask a question at the press conference. And then McCain leaves because, of course, in order to hold the press conference, in order to walk around outside the green zone, they had to bring in 100 armed troops. And 3 Black Hawk helicopters and 2 Apache gunships and numerous, infiltrators? I don't know what you call them, the spies, informants, whatever, members of the Iraqi military in civilian uniform to populate the streets to look out for anything that might happen. And today, the day later, the report, now this from the Boston Globe, the crack of shots fired by unseen snipers echoed on Monday through Baghdad's wholesale Shorja market, a day after U.S. Senator John McCain held up his visit there as one sign of improving security in Baghdad. At the same time, as CNN notes, last week's suicide truck bombing in the northern city of Tal Afar is the, and this was, by the way, just preceding John McCain's visit, is the deadliest single attack since the beginning of the Iraq War in 2003, a high-ranking Iraqi Interior Ministry official said Monday, as a new death toll for the blast surfaced. So here we have this absolute and utter disaster, and it ain't getting better. It ain't getting better. And why? So that George W. Bush could gain political capital. I mean, I keep coming back to this. People say, well, it's a war for oil. Sure. Yeah, that's why there was a whole bunch of people in this administration pushing for it, and it's why, you know, a whole bunch of people in industry were pushing for it was, yeah, let's get some oil. And, in fact, that's embedded in the occupation thing. But, no, I think it was for political capital. I really do, from Bush's point of view. So, anyhow, Gary Trudeau in Doonesbury, this over the weekend. Sarge, this you got a couple of soldiers. A couple of GIs in Iraq. Sarge, I don't understand the debate in Congress. He says, how is cutting off war funds not supporting the troops? Does it mean we'd be stranded here without ammo or rations? And the sergeant says, no, of course not. It just means we'd have to withdraw. And so the GI says, really? So if Congress doesn't support the troops, I go home to my family. But if they do support us, we have to keep returning to the meat grinder. And the sergeant says, right. And the GI says, okay, I don't want to sound ungrateful. And the sergeant says, permission to think it through denied. But it was like, yeah. So if Bush vetoes the spending bill, the one that's going to him right now, if he vetoes this thing, and then Congress says, all right, thank you very much, we're done. We're going home. What's Bush going to do? You know, the money will always be there to pull the troops out. The Pentagon has a massive budget. We spend more on defense, in quotes, an awful lot of his offensive, but we spend more on what we call defense here in the United States than every other government in the world combined. They have plenty of money to pull the soldiers out of Iraq in a safe, reasonable, you know, fairly rapid, but you know, in a fashion that's safe to the soldiers. So we can get them out of there. So I'd say to the senators and members of Congress, just don't, you know, if Bush vetoes it, just say, okay, that's it. See you later. No more money.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Even when your hope is gone, move along, just to make it through. When all you gotta keep is strong, move along, like I know you do. And even when your hope is gone, move along, just to make it through.
It's the radio support group of By It For We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. That's me. I've been telling you for a long time, saying it doesn't matter who's in charge, it's the parade, right? It's us. If enough of us get outspoken, if enough of us speak up, if enough of us show up, then the, quote, leadership, end quote, who are actually representatives, not leaders, will begin reflecting the will of the majority. And sure enough, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid announced today, this from Raw Story, that if President Bush vetoes a supplemental appropriations bill, which includes a timetable for withdrawing troops from Iraq, then he will co-sponsor a bill which would cut off funding for the war in 1 year's time. According to a press release, the bill would require the president to begin safely redeploying U.S. forces from Iraq 120 days from enactment. In other words, he has 4 months from the time the bill is passed to begin withdrawing troops, and then he has 8 months to get them out. As required by the emergency supplemental spending bill the Senate passed last week, and ends funding for the war with three narrow exceptions effective March 31st, 2008. Senator Russ Feingold put this thing forward, and Harry Reid says he is going to co-sponsor it. He says, I'm pleased to co-sponsor Senator Feingold's important legislation. I believe it's consistent with the language included in the supplemental appropriations bill passed by a bipartisan majority of the Senate. If the president vetoes the supplemental appropriations bill and continues to resist changing course in Iraq, I will work to ensure that this legislation receives a vote in the Senate in the next work period. Russ Feingold says this is similar to a bill he sponsored back in the 90s to withdraw U.S. soldiers from Somalia. He says, but in 1993, senators overwhelmingly supported successful efforts to cut off funding for a flawed military operation. 76 senators voted for an amendment offered by Robert Byrd to end funding for our military mission in Somalia. None of them acted to jeopardize the safety and security of U.S. troops in Somalia. All of them recognized that Congress had the power and the responsibility to bring our military operations in Somalia to a close by establishing a date after which funds would be terminated. It's very simple. As I said, I would even take it a step further. Bush, if Congress does not pass another appropriations bill saying, okay, George, you didn't like the last one, we'll give you what you wanted. If they don't pass another one, then Bush has to begin withdrawing troops in July. What's wrong with that? I mean, maybe I'm missing something here, but it just, you know, if there's enough money to quote, fight this war, in other words, to maintain the occupation of Iraq through July, if Bush has enough money to do that, and he claims the authority to do it, that's a whole question, another questionable thing. But, you know, to make it all nice and neat and tidy, Congress really should go on record and say, sorry, you no longer have the authority. If he has enough money to maintain this occupation through July, then You know, say, fine, you got enough money to go through July. It's March now, or it's April now. It's April 2nd. You can go through July and then get everybody out. Redeploy the troops elsewhere. We're not giving you any more money for Iraq. Sorry. Unless you come to us and you say, I want something that looks like a Marshall Plan where it's not going to go to Halliburton and it's not going to go to big multinational corporations. It's going to go to small Iraqi businesses and Iraq's cement industry and steel industry, et cetera, to rebuild Iraq. Leonard in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Leonard, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm pretty darn angry. I got to be honest with you, Tom. And I call into this show and other shows on Air America because it helps me let off my frustration. I listen to the ladies from Code Pink and the rest of them about nonviolence, and I strongly believe in it. But being that I got back from Iraq last year as an MP, my National Guard unit here from Arizona, we used to patrol regularly the streets of Baghdad and the rest of it. If you even took a lieutenant colonel out, you had to have much more manpower, much more security, much less pathetic politicians like John McCain, who use my fellow soldiers and endanger their lives to get more votes, run for political office. This is exactly why, Mr. Hartman, we are recalling John McCain down here in Arizona. We're not going to stop. We have to see this guy's face plastered on the front page of our newspaper almost every day here. And he is a liar. To say
Leonard, Let's take a deep breath here. But you're absolutely right. This is a photo op. This is a stunt. And in order to do it, McCain had to round up hundreds of soldiers who could have been doing something ideally more productive or could have been in a much safer situation, and threw them into that meat grinder.
Well, all that counts is the fact that he goes down there and he has all these soldiers risk their lives. And you know what, Mr. Hartman, I would suggest to everybody, Cliff Schechter is an excellent journalist. Go to his website, therealmccain.com, and you can see everything that he's doing down there. But this man is so desperate to make the presidency of this country that he puts our American soldiers at life. This is like Nixon with Kissinger. These politicians make me sick. My fellow American soldiers are dying. They're treated like some kind of G.I. Joe expendable doll, and I am just so sick of it. I don't understand how these people live with themselves. So thank you, Mr. Hartman, and you have a good day.
Thank you, Leonard. I appreciate your call. And I share your sentiment. And I share your outrage. And let's not underestimate the power of an awakened populace. You know, Richard Nixon was seriously considering using nuclear weapons in Vietnam. Henry Kissinger apparently had advised him to do it. He was planning on doing it. I mean, Richard Nixon was going to use tactical nuclear weapons in Vietnam. He saw that as the only way to, quote, win that war. Another occupation of a foreign country. It just doesn't work. Occupying foreign countries doesn't work. But he saw nukes as the way to do it. And this massive anti-war protest happened in Washington, D.C. A million people showed up, more or less. And Nixon looked out and saw all those people and got it. Now, I don't know what vision he had in his mind. Maybe it was from an old horror movie where the people with the pitchforks and the torches were standing outside the castle. But he got it, that if he defied the will of the people in such a huge way as to use nukes in Vietnam, that he would be toast. And he decided, as a consequence of that anti-war protest, and we didn't learn this until, you know, just what, 4 or 5 years ago? I mean, it took decades for us to learn this. He decided, as the result of an anti-war protest, not to use nuclear weapons. If Iran is not attacked this week or next, which was the window that the Bush administration was planning on. If Iran is not attacked, it's because we were out in the streets, we were mobilized, we were contacting our elected representatives, and the support for the attack of Iran was cut out from underneath Bush. It's because of us. We just can't ever forget that. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jay. I just want to say, number one,
it's Tom.
Thank you to Leonard. And two quick points. First of all, there are a lot of Vietnam vets like me who are still alive today because Congress pulled the plug on Tricky Dick in 1970. God bless Gary Trudeau.
Yeah, yeah.
We're here because Congress had cut funds and would not let Nixon go back. So this talk about commander-in-chief and they know it isn't true. Second thing is Potemkin villages. Think about generals who get promoted. They get promoted for winning, not for losing. That means the McCain's baloney in Baghdad is another Potemkin village. After the general gets his next star, he gets reassigned and somebody else gets left holding the bag. Yeah. It's people like Leonard and the grunts in Vietnam that end up dying for somebody else's next star. Thank you.
Yeah, well said, Ralph. Thank you very much. Catherine in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Catherine.
Hi, Tom. I'm just as frustrated as your last callers. And 4 weeks ago Thursday, there was a World War II vet. And it was so sad. And I felt so bad for how broken up he was that I started calling my senators and my congressmen every day. And I'm letting them know we're out here and we need some help, you know. Mm-hmm. And so you are like the Thomas Jefferson of this era. And I think you need to rally your 2 million people strong troops. And how about every day maybe we could get them to call the Congress, the Senate, and the
Catherine,
White House.
Catherine, it's all of us. We're all in this together. I am no more a leader than our...
But you're the leader.
No, I'm not. This show is the voice through which you are speaking. Right? You're speaking it, right? Well, there goes Catherine. Okay. Thanks a lot, Catherine, for the call. I appreciate it. The point is that, yes, I agree with you that we all need to be contacting our elected representatives. My point is that we have been. People are getting out there and they are knocking on the doors of Congress and they are calling people. And I so salute you for that. And I just, you know, I'm not a leader here either. I'm a talk show host. By the way, Agence France-Presse reporting that it looks like the U.S. military is trying to provoke Iran again. I'll give you the details of that in just a second. Tom Hartman with you, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Some multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you 9.5 minutes before the hour. And I just want to, you know, the folks in the chat room, you know, one of them says, you know, Tom, no, you are a leader on this. No, you don't get it. This is just like calling politicians leaders. I mean, I can say, oh, we all ought to do this or that. If I say, well, we all ought to jump off a cliff, is everybody going to jump? I don't think so. What I'm doing is laying out the information and suggesting, you know, hey, you know, this is what I think would be a good idea. This is what you might want to think about. And you know, good ideas will get picked up, and they're not necessarily mine. I mean, they reach a certain critical mass. It is the same thing with our elected officials, and frankly, in my opinion. And it's not that I'm saying, no, I will not accept a mantle of leadership. It is that I think that it's the wrong metaphor for all of us to be believing is real. I think that we really need to think of ourselves as living in a democracy, and that the first three words of the Constitution, we the people, that's where the power is. And that's where it needs to stay. And we are we the people, all of us, every single one of us. And I trust every one of your discriminating ability, your ability to know you know, right from wrong and decide, you know, a good idea from a bad idea and then make decisions based on that. Ellen Ratner on the line with us of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Hi. Well, we got a couple of good decisions from the Supreme Court and one bad decision from the Supreme Court today. 5-4, gives the authority to regulate emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases from cars to the EPA. Very good
right.
news.
Yeah. And, now the bad news, half of that one is that the EPA is still run by the Bush administration.
Well, but there's hope. We have a year and a half left.
That's right.
A little over a year and a half. And the Supreme Court also said that there was a Duke Energy Corporation lawsuit, was a Clinton administration lawsuit, to force power plants to install some kind of pollution controls. And, yes, they actually have a right to do that. The lower court did not overstep its bounds. They said the lower court did overstep its bounds in invalidating the EPA, so the EPA wins on that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So those are two good pieces of information. The bad piece of information is my brother is not a happy camper today from the Center for Constitutional Rights. 6-3, not to hear an appeal of a federal court's decision that essentially found that these prisoners could go through their trials in Guantanamo. Now, what that means is the court, though, is open to hearing. Once these trials are done, they're open to hearing the prisoners
appeals.
To go to the appeal and go to the Supreme Court. So that's good, because the three justices that voted initially in what I consider a wrong decision, which essentially Stevens, Kennedy, and Stevens and Kennedy, yes, will vote, looks like with Breyer, Ginsburg, and Souter, to hear an appeal after they are done with their hearings. So those are not a great decision. In fact, a pretty bad decision. My brother says these people will be languishing there for at least another year till these hearings get done. But at least they can come back to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. What amazes me, Ellen, and for our listeners who don't know, Ellen Ratner's brother is Michael Ratner, who's the director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. CCR-NY.org is their website. And it's a great organization and worthy of your support. What blows my mind is I've been watching the British media, and the Brits are all in a self-righteous lather about the fact that the Iranians humiliated these captured British soldiers by showing a photograph of a woman smoking a cigarette, one of the soldiers, and by parading them in front of cameras where they are making confessions. We capture folks in the Middle East, and we put bags over their heads, and we beat them with pipes and bars until their muscles have turned to pulp, and we sick dogs on them, and we hold them in stress positions for days at a time. We lock them up in solitary confinement for years at a time. When they walk from room to room or building to building, they have to wear a hood and glasses and earmuffs. They're absolute sensory deprivation. We experiment with drugs on them. We call all this enhanced interrogation. It's not torture. The Iranians, as far as we can tell, have done none of this, and yet the British are saying they're inhuman?
Well, you know, I saw a cartoon, and I can't remember where, over the weekend, that has somebody, an Ayatollah being led by, you know, a guy with whips and chains and all that kind of stuff, and says, and then, you know, it shows the Brits in prison saying, don't worry, we're going to treat you exactly like people are treated in the CIA prisons. And,
right.
It is a cartoon, but you're exactly right. And that's exactly what's happening. And, how do they look at themselves with a straight face in the mirror, the Brits?
Yeah.
But,
Yeah, for that matter. I mean, it's just this should be a moment, a national or an international moment of oh my, you know, did we really do that? Did we really do that? I'm amazed, frankly, that Mr. Gates, this new Secretary of Defense, has called for closing Guantanamo, and Bush is saying no. And Gates still has his job, and it's just the whole thing is starting to seem like...
Fire Gates. Gates is in a very good position because he hasn't been there that long, so he still has sort of the bully pulpit, and Bush cannot fire Gates or he is really going to look bad. So Gates is in a very safe position right now.
Yeah. Confirm for me, Ellen, that the Gary Trudeau-Doonesbury over the weekend scenario is right, that if Congress refuses to vote for any more money for Iraq, that Bush has to pull the soldiers out?
Well, either that or he has to find a very creative way of moving money around.
Yeah. Okay. So that would be one way to end the war, is simply accept his veto and say, okay, fine, no legislation. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen. Coming up next, Bill McKibben.
Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain.
So how do we fix the economy? How do we bring about some sense of balance, not just between rich and poor, but between humans and all other forms of life on the planet? How do we create a future which actually works, not just some cliched, oh, it's sustainable, but actually works? And how do we deal with some of the problems of global warming? The big issues of our day. Bill McKibben has always taken on the big issues of our day, and he's doing it again. His new book, Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. His website, Bill McKibben, McKibben.com. And Bill, very, very pleased to have you in the studio with us. Welcome.
Tom, it's so much fun to be here after listening to you all these years.
It's great. It's great to have you here, Bill. Tell me, first of all, before we get to deep economy, I want to talk about this Step It Up thing you're doing. You were just telling me a little bit about this before we went on the air. How did this start?
It actually started in Vermont last summer.
Let's actually say what it is so people know what we're talking about.
It's going to be the first big nationwide protest about global warming. And it's going to happen on April 14th, and it's exploding in ways that we couldn't have imagined. Last summer, we were sitting around Vermont, a few of us, and just despairing over the fact that even though people knew about global warming now and they'd seen Al Gore's movie and they'd watched Hurricane Katrina, nothing was going on. We still had James Inhofe, running the show on the Senate, whatever. We said, we've got to do something. So a few of us got together and we did this march across Vermont for 5 days. By the time we got to Burlington, we had 1,000 people, which in Vermont, as you know, is a lot of people. And it changed our politics there in Vermont. It convinced all the candidates for Congress, even the real conservative Republicans, boy, we better get on board with this, and they did. We wanted to try to do the same thing on a national level, but we had no money and we had no organization. So on January 10th, six kids who'd graduated from Middlebury College, where I teach, and I launched a website, stepitup07.org. We asked people, organize rallies in your local communities on April 14th. We could have done a march on Washington, but A, we didn't have the money to do it, and B, we didn't want people spewing carbon, as they
fossil
the
fuels
continent.
To get there, yeah.
So do it in your community, and then we'll, if you do it on April 14th, we'll knit it together with, you upload pictures for us, we thought maybe we might be able to organize 100 of these things by April 14th, which would have been about 100 more than there had been before. Instead, the thing has taken off like some, nice version of the bird flu or something. Mm-hmm. As of today, we're going to go past the 1,200 rally mark. They're going to take place in every state in the union, and people are coming up with the most unbelievable. I mean, in Florida, they're going to be teams of scuba divers doing underwater demonstrations with our banner off the endangered coral reefs.
Wow.
In the parking lot of the Jacksonville Jaguars football stadium, they're having a big party. They're going to hoist a boat on a crane 20 feet up in the air to show where the sea level is going to be if Greenland melts. In lower Manhattan, thousands of people in blue shirts crowding into the form a sort of sea of people to show where the new tide line is going to be.
Whoa.
Up on the, in Portland, Portland, Oregon. There are going to be people up on Mount Hood. There's going to be march through town. There's going to be hundreds of people jumping into the Columbia River in a kind of polar bear swim. There's going to be, and just around the country, it just gets, people just have the most unbelievably great ideas. And, every day people are adding new ones at this stepitup07.org site. It's It's out of control in a good way.
Yeah, and you're, of course, on book tour for Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future, and at the same time playing Johnny Appleseed. You're going to be in Los Angeles on Wednesday. You were in Seattle yesterday. It's all over at BillMcKibben.com, your schedule, right?
I'm doing my best to keep myself going through April 14th and then retreating back home, never to speak to anyone again. That's my plan anyway.
And you're here in the studio here in Portland, Oregon, the People's Republic of Portland. With us today, Bill McKibben. Let's talk about, and the website, once again, that Bill was talking about is stepitup07.org. Let's talk about deep economy,
yeah.
The wealth of communities, the echoes of Adam Smith in there. I'm assuming that was not unintentional.
Not unintentional. Look, the one unexamined assumption in our society, the one default assumption of everything, is that more is better and growth is good. And it tends to be liberals and conservatives sort of equally holding
sure.
this idea.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, no, our way of growing is green.
Quicker than yours.
That's right.
Well,
yeah,
I mean,
we'll grow with solar panels instead of with fossil fuel. Plants.
Well, or, you know, it was Khrushchev, you know, pounding his shoe on the table at the UN and saying, we're going to outgrow you. And, you
right.
know, well, we
yeah.
won that one. But it may turn out to be a Pyrrhic victory. And for two reasons. I mean, one, the kind of obvious one that I've spent my life working on is the ecological cost of that growth. I mean, I wrote the first book on global warming, The End of Nature, way back in 1989. Right. So I've gotten to watch this thing.
And a book on zero population
yep.
growth. One is enough.
But the second reason, and the other sort of thing that we've just learned in the last 10 years as economists and sociologists have begun to really look into it is all the growth that we've been doing in this country really isn't making us any happier. And that's a really interesting idea. I mean, there's one polling firm that every year since the end of World War II has asked Americans, are you happy? And the number of Americans who say, I'm very happy, peaks in 1956, which annoyingly is 4 years before I was born, so I don't really know what was going on back then, but peaks then and sort of goes slowly downhill. There's about 25% of Americans will say, I'm very happy, which is really weird because the amount of stuff that we have has about tripled per capita since then. When we have houses twice as big, many more vacations, lots more appliances, on and on and on.
Oh, I remember 1956. I was 5 years old, and I think that was the year we got our first television, and it was a black and white TV.
Well, that's an important piece of data.
And that was the year that my father bought the house that he died in last summer, finally paid off, and he bought it for $13,000, as I recall, in Lansing, Michigan. I mean, he worked in tool and die shop, and we were middle class America, and I always felt like life was pretty good.
What seems to have happened is, If any of the things we told ourselves about the economy were true, those two curves, income and satisfaction, would have at least gone in somewhat the same direction, not
yeah.
split apart. What seems to have happened is just what you were sort of describing. People began taking that money, and what did we do with it? We built bigger houses farther out in the suburbs, and we got the first of the set of screens that we've been peering into for the last five decades.
Right.
We got a tremendous amount of social disconnection and loss of community. That's what the data shows is driving that dissatisfaction. And it's not just coincidental to all that prosperity. In a certain sense, it's a product of it. And, you know, the average American has half as many close friends as they did 50 years ago. That's a big change, and it turns out that it's a bigger change than having twice as much square footage in your house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not better off than we were.
So what's the solution here, Bill McKibben?
I think the solution is heading in the direction of more localized economies that, A, will save us a lot on energy, you know, food not having to travel 2,000 miles, and, B, will start bringing those communities back together. A pair of sociologists followed shoppers around farmers markets a few years ago. They found that people were having 10 times as many conversations when they went to the farmer's market as the supermarket.
Because they saw their neighbors, because they were interacting with the people who grew
their
food.
They weren't in that kind of light trance that you fall into at the Shop and Save, you know,
right.
where you just sort of make the Stations of the Cross and
right.
come out with the same crap you had last year. Yeah.
yeah.
You know, it's a whole different thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this Step It Up thing almost kind of proves what we're talking about. Instead of a march in Washington, we've got all these local activities. But because we live in an Internet age, we can also figure out how to link them together. You don't have to choose between the small town and the big world. You can live now in a tightly knit community with a window open to the rest of the planet.
That's it's great. And so, therefore, deep economy. Let's rethink our, you know, the basic assumptions that we've been operating under.
Let's think about what we want out of the economy instead of thinking of ourselves as our only role is to make it grow larger.
Yeah. Adbusters had an ad where they pointed out that every time a cancer is diagnosed, GDP goes up. Every time there's an oil spill, GDP goes up.
The most economically productive guy in the world, you know, has a car accident on the way from his divorce lawyer to his chemotherapy appointment. I mean, think about the money that guy is churning through the system.
That's right. He's generating all kinds of GDP.
And we don't want any of that happening.
Right, right. So the summary ad of the ad, they said, if we are to survive, economists need to learn how to subtract.
That's it.
Got it. Bill McKibben with us. His website, Bill McKibben, mckibben.com. And, of course, stepitup07.org, his new project. He's the author of Deep Economy, his newest book, Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. Bill, thanks for being with us today.
Well, what fun, Tom.
Good talking with you. We'll get back to Alberto Gonzalez right after this, 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
The Tom Hartman Program, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors, like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, The Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, and Purina One Natural Blends at 866-380-MEOW, as well as listening for the sponsors on your local station. That's really where the rubber meets the road. They're the folks that are keeping this show on the air, if you're listening to it on a local affiliate. Notice who those sponsors are. Support them, buy their products, but you can also support them just by calling them up and saying, hey, I heard your name on the show today, and I appreciate that you're sponsoring it, and I will recommend your products to other people, even if I don't need to buy a new car from you. I'll tell my next, you know, friend who's thinking about it, and let them know that you're listening. It's an important and useful thing, and, you know, much value there. You've heard about this Australian who cut the deal with the War Crimes Tribunal. It looks like there's starting to be some blowback here, Mr. Hicks, David Hicks. The deal was, and this is where it gets weird. I mean, this detainee is going to serve 9 months in Australia. This was one of those high-value prisoners that was transferred to Guantanamo. And under the deal, and he was one of the first guys to have a trial, And now increasingly in Australia, people are saying, hey, wait a minute, is this because our esteemed leader who has been running around saying, yes, we support Mr. Bush, we support Mr. Bush, that in fact what's going on is that a deal was cut? That a deal was cut to make everybody look good here? The judge also said, under the deal, Hicks stipulated that he has, quote, never been illegally treated by a person or persons while in the custody of the U.S. government, end quote. He thanked U.S. service members for their professionalism during his imprisonment. The judge also said the agreement bars Hicks. Now, here's the kicker. This is a guy who, you know, we know was subject to what, if it was being done right now by Iran to British prisoners, we would call torture. Just think about that for a minute. If the Iranians took one of those British prisoners
and shackled her to a bed frame that was welded to a wall so that she couldn't move for days at a time and was stuck there in her own feces and urine, or shackled her or him to a floor in a stress position where the thighs had to be kept absolutely horizontal so that the muscles would eventually give out, or was put in solitary confinement for years. Even a few days, actually, typically is enough to psychologically break somebody, the studies that they've done on this. Absolute, I'm talking about total sensory deprivation, where you hear absolutely nothing. Lights on constantly, 24 hours a day. The only change is it gets hot, very, very hot, very, very cold. So here's the kicker. The judge said the agreement bars Hicks from suing the U.S. government for alleged abuse. He forfeits any right to appeal his conviction. And the plea agreement imposes a gag order that prevents him from speaking with news media for a year from his sentencing date. Now, there are those in Australia who are suggesting that John Howard, the Prime Minister of Australia, cut a deal. And Jeff Holland, a University of Technology Sydney expert on free speech, he says, I can accept the imposition of a no-profit clause, but not being able to speak to the media for a year? You've got to question what's going to be achieved by gagging him for that length of time. If it's something he's going to say that would compromise Australian security, then one would expect the gag would be ongoing. The Green Party leader in Australia, Bob Brown, he says the gag had been sought by the Howard government. He says, it's a fix! Senator Brown says, the message has gone very clearly from Canberra to Washington to Guantanamo Bay. Don't allow Hicks to be released until after the Australian elections, and certainly don't allow him to speak. It's tawdry, it's despicable, it's a political fix overriding what should have been an Australian justice matter right from the outset. Now, in the meantime, we're hearing this from Agence France-Presse. U.S. warplanes have violated Iranian space in the southwestern oil-rich province of Khuzestan. El Alam Arabic language news satellite channel quoted a local military chief as saying yesterday, two aircraft, this is the quote from the local media, from Iran, two aircraft trespassed into Iranian airspace northwest of the southwestern port city of Abadan before flying southwest into Iraq. The planes left white vapor trails, attracting the local people's attention, he said. The incident happened close to Iran's border with Iraq, where the U.S. and British military are deployed in force. So, here we have, we're covering up our crimes against humanity in Australia, with this Australian David Hicks. At the same time, that are we trying to provoke another one? Somehow, I just don't think the Bush is going to follow through this, but we'll see. 27 minutes past the hour. Your call's next.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Hour. Tom Hartman here with you, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Interesting news of the day. Turns out that the attempts to fire various attorneys general seem to have an awful lot to do, this is from Newsweek, by the way, have an awful lot to do with the individual attorneys, the individual U.S. attorneys, not trying to prosecute groups that are registering African-American voters, Hispanic voters, minority voters. And then the U.S. attorneys said to the Republicans, these guys aren't committing a crime. They're registering voters. And the Republican politician said to the U.S. attorneys, no, no, you have to prosecute these guys. But there's no crime. No, you have to prosecute them. It's voter fraud. No, it's not voter fraud. They're just... This is ACORN, the activist group that was registering these, you know, folks in their in minority neighborhoods. New disclosure, this is from Newsweek. New disclosures in the U.S. attorney controversy have increased the pressure on U.S. White House aide Karl Rove. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez's chief, ex-chief and staff, D. Kyle Simpson. And he told the story. Running up during the run-up to the midterm election, Rove had complained that David Iglesias, the U.S. attorney in New Mexico, and two other federal prosecutors were not doing enough to prosecute what they call voter fraud. A top GOP priority. It was shortly after that Samson said that Iglesias got added to the list of U.S. attorneys to be fired. And this was all about they wanted him to prosecute ACORN. Amazing. Now, that said, because there's so much going on, I'm going to hop around here a little bit. The situation in Iran, or Iran, I guess is the correct pronunciation, in Iran right now, a good, just quick summary of the history of this from the University of Maryland's Center for Persian Studies, quoted in today's Wall Street Journal. Just consider the history and just imagine for a minute that you lived in Iran. In 1907, Britain and Russia carve Iran up into what they called spheres of influence. A year later, the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, what is today known as BP, strikes oil in Iran. The Qajar dynasty is rising up, and they're getting some power. So about 15 years later, 1921, Britain overthrows the local government and replaces it with Reza Shah Pahlavi, a former military officer. Makes him basically king. But he didn't always go along with them. 11 years later, he pulls the Anglo-Persian oil company's oil monopoly. Says, this oil's ours. So 9 years after that, 1941, Britain forces him to abdicate and installs his son, Mohammad Shah Pahlavi. In 53, Britain teams up with the U.S. and Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi to depose the prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, the guy who had been elected, democratically elected, and wanted to nationalize the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. We're back to BP here again. That was 53. 79, the United Kingdom withdrew its ambassador when the Iranian Revolution toppled the Shah. In 88, the UK ambassador was restored to Tehran. We still don't have an ambassador there. Now, what are the Iranians... I mean, they're looking around going, okay, we have the Iran has a 100-year history of British Petroleum, the company that is now BP, fighting over whether or not they have the right to control Iranian oil. And the U.S. and the United Kingdom are talking about attacking Iran. And they've just got to be saying, you know, when they talked about attacking North Korea, the North Koreans got the bomb, and they stopped talking about attacking North Korea. Maybe there's a lesson here for us. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Hey, Roy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Gee, it's great to have you national now. And I purposely kind of stayed back from calling in, but after this weekend, I thought I'd give you a heads up. We had our Sandoval County Democratic Club meeting, or not club mm-hmm. meeting, precinct, ward, and county meeting this weekend. And us activists were working to get the guys out and the gals out, and we didn't do a real good job. I mean, we did okay, but we didn't get the fence setters, let's put it that way. And the old-timers, the ones that we kind of pushed around and kicked out 2 years ago, kind of came back and came awfully close to gaining their ground back.
Uh-oh,
so the
local
reason
Democratic
for my
Party.
Call is twofold. Number
let me,
one.
Let me just give a little background here, Roy, for our longtime listeners recognize your voice and know who you are. I actually tell your story in the last chapter of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. about how you guys, you became politically active. You've joined your local Democratic Party and with a bunch of friends basically showed up and progressives, you and a bunch of progressives essentially took it over. And it's a great example of how activism should work from the grassroots up.
And it was fun. It was work and it was exciting and it was fun. The thing was that we didn't even anticipate. We heard no rumors of the old timers trying to get it back. Well, there's going to be lots of state meetings, and it's hard to get people out because it's not an election year. Mm. But that's the bad news. But the good news is if you can get them out, it should be easy to take over these weak organizations.
Yeah.
Because if we hadn't been on the phone getting our folks fired up to get back out and getting the – if we were using ones to tens, you know, if they're really devout as tens and the – their vote is ones. If we hadn't gotten the sixes and the sevens out, we'd have gotten beat.
Yeah.
But we were able to get them out and maintain.
So what are you going to do now, Roy, to get them to get your activist base back into the Democratic Party again?
We're just basically what we've been doing, just getting the word out. But we're going to use this as an example of, hey, we cannot let it down.
Yeah,
and
look
we'll
out
be
or,
making
or the
phone
old...
calls and the emails and the Democratic Club and those kinds of things, and we'll be working with the old timers because they are not the corporate type; they're just the ones that liked it the way it used to be.
Mm.
We'll be
in
showing,
other words, ineffective.
You know, we'll be offering them the hand. In fact, I do have to admit that the old timers candidate for county chair, the votes came in, and before they announced the vote, she stood up and she said, I want to make a motion. I want to withdraw my candidacy.
Hmm.
And I want.
Interesting. So in other words, they're seeing which way the wind is blowing too.
They backed out with class.
Yeah. Well, that's
but
good.
It is so important that people, A, get out, because this being an off-year election cycle, the chances of being able to take over from the mediocrity should be a lot easier if you can get the people motivated. If you've made some gains, get out and keep the gains that we've got.
There you go. Well said.
And have a good one.
Thank you.
Talk to you sometime.
Okay, good on you for what you're doing there and getting people out and getting people motivated and getting people active. It's marvelous. Jerry in Long Island. Hey, Jerry.
Yeah, thanks very much for taking my call. Yeah, speaking about getting people motivated, on the U.S. Attorney purge scandal, we have a president, obviously, who's drunk with power, and Democrats in Congress have these major opportunities, I believe, to either stand up to him and show that they really have a spine after all, which would be their political advantage, or to instead, as usual, sadly, and I think quite shamefully and spinelessly cave into Bush and pretty much give him what he wants with respect to who testifies publicly under oath and who does not. And for instance, I was disturbed to read this past weekend in a New York Times editorial that it seems like already the House of Representatives has cut a deal with Monica Goodling, who refused to publicly testify under oath to Senator Leahy of Vermont for fear of being prosecuted, she said, for perjury, which to me is all the more reason to put her under oath and penalty of perjury. And,
but it may not be such a bad thing. I mean, they cut a deal with Monica Lewinsky, and look at where it led, Jerry.
Well, it is a bad thing. I'll tell you why, because why would she or anyone else fear being prosecuted for perjury and be afraid to take an oath to tell the truth unless they intended to lie? And as far as
Jerry, calm down for a minute. The deal may well be that, and frankly, we don't know the details of this, but I would guess that the deal would be you will testify truthfully under oath and we will immunize you from prosecution for what you say. So, you can't go to jail for what you say. And if that's the case, then that's a deal I think that we could all live with and would actually be a good and desirable thing. By the way, I just wanted to add, before we've got to take a break in just a second here, but just wanted to add, Matthew Dowd over the weekend, this was a big story in the New York Times, Friday afternoon, Saturday, something like that, over the weekend. In any case, Matthew Dowd, the guy who was the chief campaign strategist for Bush's 2004 campaign, has come out and said that he is, opposed to the war now that his son is about to be deployed, by the way, he is opposed to the war, and that he doesn't support Bush anymore. And so, of course, as soon as he says this, now Dan Bartlett says, oh, he's in personal turmoil. They're slashing his character. They're going, it's like slash and burn politics. So I didn't want to let that slip by. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where reason is our lifestyle choice.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Led into another senseless war. How many thousands must lay dead before we wake up from this nightmare and revive the American dream? If we blindly stay the course, this horse will drown us in the stream. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Don't stay course, on a course that's going the wrong way.
It's the Trip People's Radio. Tom Hartman here with you 9.5 minutes before the top of the hour, before the end of our 3 hours with you here today. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. Lawrence in Berkeley, California, listening real quick.
Hey, Lawrence, hi. What's up? Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
That's good. I'm glad. I wanted to talk to Bill McKibben. I'm sad he's not there, but I'll talk to you. Two things, you know, one I agree with and one I don't. He's right when he says that the decline of happiness in the United States is the result of a lack of community. We know that from the book Bowling Alone, and people have
sure.
half as many friends.
Malcolm Dowell's work, yeah.
Right. But when he says that the decline of community is a direct result of wealth or of technology, it's really dangerous to the progressive point of view. Because the decline of community is not because we have more decline of community is because our wealth and our technology has been taken over by the billionaire corporations, not because it's there.
Oh, that's an interesting point. In other words, if we all have TVs in our house, but the TVs were being used, much like the Internet is, to have local cable, for example, some communities. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. Louise and I have lived in a variety of communities around the United States over the years. Some places have very, very vibrant local cable access communities. I mean, people actually watch the local cable access because there's interesting programming and people doing things. Mm-hmm. And others, it's just a kind of a vast wasteland.
Well, more than that, I mean, United States is now the most unequal country in the industrialized world. You know, the rich
right.
are the richest and the poor are the poorest. And not coincidentally, about 3 years ago, we surpassed the Japanese and became number one in the world in the number of hours that we work per year.
Right, and we're starting to approach their numbers in suicides.
Yes, and we did that because people have to work. You know, if you're working minimum wage, you have to work two or three jobs just to make up because all the money is going to the rich and they're not giving it to us. Or, you know, we have cars that the whole car culture that creates private malls instead of real civic spaces. Well, that was created directly by a conspiracy of the corporations. I'm sure you know about it, but most people don't, about the fact that in the 1940s, the oil companies and the car companies formed a consortium that went around and bought up all of the city, the intercity trolley cars and trains for the sole purpose of putting them out of the business. So they could then build freeways.
Well, GM and Goodyear were then prosecuted for that.
And they were found guilty, and they were fined the princely sum of $10,000, and they've made hundreds of billions selling their cars on freeways, which have caused us the more pollution and the global warming and destroyed our community spaces. So
you know, to
no, your point is well taken, Lawrence, that this goes beyond just, you know, isn't technology great or bad, or for that matter, the message of consumerism, that it is really time for us to, this is the, you know, my call from the first hour, let's bring back the Sherman Act. Let's start breaking up some of these huge combines. I mean, this is what we began the program with, and you did a great job bringing it back around, and I thank you for that, and thank you for the call. Gene in New York City. Hey, Gene, what's on your mind today?
Well, let's get to the Sherman Act and Monica Goodling and the prosecutor's scandal, all of which tie into this decades-old campaign by conservatives to subvert both the Justice Department and the courts. Now, I want you to rewind.
Let's put this in the largest frame, Gene, which ties into a decades-old campaign by conservatives to destroy democracy in the United States and replace it with essentially aristocracy and oligarchy.
Exactly. Now, let's focus again on the courts. Remember how you'd always hear the Republicans saying, oh, Democrats have a litmus test for the Supreme Court. You've got to be anti-abortion. Well, you know, I can get into how that's, you know, Republican projection and a complete lie. But, you know, if Republicans are so desperate for Democrats to have a litmus test, how about this one? If you have ever been a member of the seditionist, traitorous Federalist Society, and everybody who's listening who doesn't know what that is, go look it up on Wikipedia. If you've ever been involved with the Federalist Society, you won't even make it past committee. You'll be laughed out because you're a traitor to our values.
Here's the problem, Gene. More than half of all our federal judges are members of the Federalist Society.
Well, we can bring that to an end very quickly. What we've got to do is we've got to make that the litmus test. You've ever been a member of the seditionist group? You're out of here.
Yeah, see, and I'm sure that the Federalist Society and their members would not characterize themselves the way that you have, although I have to say that I share many of your concerns of the goals of the Federalist Society, that their view of humanity is much more Thomas Hobbes than John Locke, and that their view of democracy is much more Alexander Hamilton than Thomas Jefferson. And although we've had that long argument all these years, it's still, you know, something that we need to consider. Gary in Los Angeles, and thanks for the call. Gary in Los Angeles. Hey, Gary, last minute of the show here. What's up?
It's Gay.
Oh, Gay, I'm sorry.
Hey, Gay. Hey, I wondered if there was anything we could do now that the attorneys are fired and they have been replaced. Is there anything we can do? Can Congress do anything to bring those people up to any kind of confirmation?
Yeah, I don't think so. The legislation that's been proposed would merely move from this point forward. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a constitutional prohibition against ex post facto laws, you know, laws that go back into the past and change how the law was, particularly with regard to criminal things. I don't think that there is anything, and it's not just the ones who got fired, by the way. There's about three times as many who got promoted out of where they were to get rid of them, and then they brought hacks in. 10 of them out of Gonzalez's office. Coming up tomorrow, Tuesday, on the Tom Hartman program, former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright will be here to talk about Iraq, Iran, and the elections. Conservative Michael Tanner is saying the Republican Party has lost touch with its Reagan-Goldwater roots. I'd say those are very different. And as always, the best of the rest of the news. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.